Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Lena Durhalli. She is a licensed psychotherapist, and she is also the author of the brand new book, My Daddy is a Hero, How Chris Watts Went from Family Man to Family Killer. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold. You can get it on Amazon and a lot of other booksellers. Lena, you took this story, this Chris Watts story that all of us remember from hearing about on the national news, and wrote a true crime book about it. But it's not your typical true crime book. You come at this from a completely different angle. So before we get into the actual murder itself, the homicides, and the subsequent investigation, what was your angle as you started this?
Well, you know, at first I started writing it just because myself, and I noticed so many other people that followed this case, and you know, this case, to this day, I think, has an international cult following. There was something that really drew people in, and I think one of those things was that this was such a unique case in the sense that this family looked like this picture-perfect family, and, you know, that happens a lot, and I tell people, I'm a psychotherapist, I know that social media doesn't always portray the truth, but you know, as you really looked into the case, Chris Watts had no warning signs, and I see couples all the time, and I usually think that I can spot someone that may have some controlling tendencies or may have some warning signs of being a potentially abusive person, whether that's emotionally, mentally, physically, but Chris Watts seemed to have none of those signs. So, you know, I sort of set out to do this deep dive into how does somebody who seems so nonviolent become violent, or did he have this dark side that he hid for so long? Did he snap? You know, these were questions that I had and that many other people had. So I wrote this book to try to answer those questions and to help people sort of make sense of this crime. And then I wanted to also take that and look at it as, well, if we can understand how violence like this happens, what are some things that we can do to prevent it, or what conversations can we open up to talk about so we can maybe help prevent some of this in the future?
The crime itself, Frederick, Colorado, it's a Denver suburb. You have the Watts family, Chris and Shanann, and their two children, CeCe, 3 years old, Bella, 4 years old. Shanann is pregnant with little Nico. August 13th of 2018, take me back to that date and that time. What happened?
Well, what's a lot of people have told me after they've read the book is what really struck them the most is how fast Shanann's friends and family knew something was deeply wrong. So Shanann had come home from a business trip on the early morning of August 13th. So it was somewhere around 2 a.m. Her flight had been delayed. She was in Arizona. And early in the morning, around 7 or 8 a.m., her best friend, Nicole, who had just dropped her off at her home at 2 a.m., had picked up her phone and noticed that Shanann wasn't texting her. And Shanann was constantly connected to people. It was sort of what she did. She was in sales. And so she was, you know, from the first thing when she'd wake up in the morning, she would post on Facebook. She would text her best friend, Nicole, after they went on these trips together. And this morning, there was radio silence. And as the morning went on, Nicole began to panic even further. So close to around lunchtime, she took her teenage son and jumped in her car and went over to the house. And she actually had the key to the house because she had watched the dog, the family dog before. And she noticed that the bolt, the lock chain on the inside of the door was still there, and she couldn't get in the house. And as they explored further, they saw in the garage that Shanann's car was still there. The car seats were still there. And at this point, Chris had been communicating with the friends, telling people, oh, she said she was going to a friend's house. Now, the girls were supposed to show up at daycare that morning. They weren't there. Shanann had an appointment with her OB to check the status of her third pregnancy with Nico. She didn't show up for that. So, you know, again, around, I think, 1 or 2 o'clock, they had called the cops to do a wellness check. And within a few days, Chris Watts had confessed to killing everyone and had revealed where the bodies were. So a really, really dark, dark story.
The thing that struck me the most was how quick law enforcement worked. And as you say, within a few days, there was a confession. But this is a guy who he worked for an energy company. He was an engineer working in the oil fields. And yet it seems like the most ill-thought-out crime because, number one, I mean, even people that are amateur sleuths watching TV know the husband's always a suspect when the people go missing. But when you see Chris Watts being interviewed asking for his family back because nobody could find them, what was it about Chris Watts that struck you as you saw him on TV that stood out to you for his reactions?
I think it wasn't just me. I think that video was really what solidified the interest in this case. You know, I've talked to so many people, and we've all had that same feeling. Is here's this guy, you know, objectively handsome guy, you know, his nice suburban home in the suburbs of Colorado. Like, it looks like a picture-perfect setting, but you have a feeling that what he's saying is disingenuous. He may be saying all the right things, but what's, you know, you get that sort of gut feeling that something's wrong. I know a lot of people, including myself, you know, we walked away after watching that interview thinking he definitely had something to do with that. And what's interesting, and it wasn't even just people who were watching the interview. It was, again, the friends and the family that had seen the interview as well. And even before that, even though they had thought Chris was the perfect husband and father, up until this point, immediately they all had this gut feeling that he had something to do with it. It was incredibly remarkable because before they never, ever would have thought he would be capable of this, but even Shanann's mother, she had this really strong feeling. You know, she was telling the detective, check his GPS. I'm worried that he went and disposed of their bodies in oil somewhere. She literally said that. That's in the book. So I was just stunned by that, too, how quickly everybody just felt that there's something really wrong with this guy.
Chris is interviewed at the police station, and he gives a very sobering explanation as to that he's not involved in all of that. And then in comes the Colorado Bureau of Investigation with the lie detector test, and you know the polygraph. All of a sudden, that's when everything's going to start falling apart. And we all know that police generally know more about what they're letting on when they give a polygraph test, and so it's going to trap the lies. My question is, and I thought about this when I read the book. Hooking him up to the polygraph test, does that only work after you've had the initial conversation with him to get the baseline of his story down, or could you simply bring him in, hook him up to a polygraph, and start it right away?
I can't answer that 100% honestly because I don't know, but I assume, just based on what I know of psychology and what I know about this stuff, is I'm pretty sure that they would probably just be able to hook him up right away and tell that he's lying. I just think that the machine is trained to pick up on these certain things, but I definitely think the initial conversation probably helped because he was already caught in so many lies, so I think he was probably more nervous at that point, but I think that he probably would have been able to, he would have failed the polygraph regardless.
So many people, when a story like this happens, try to pigeonhole it, and they say, well, he's a monster, he's a psychopath, and they throw out these terms, but it's not that simple, is it?
No, and that's, again, why I wanted to write the book, is that, you know, I really believe that when we look at violence, it's complex, and especially in this case, it was the perfect storm of factors, and I wanted to look at it from all angles. So I did look at, and, you know, psychopathy is not really a real diagnosis in our DSM, but, you know, it is thought to be a real disorder and a problematic one, and in some circles in my field, you know, psychopathy and narcissism are considered public health crises because they inflict so much damage on the population. So I did want to look at psychopathy and narcissism, but I wanted to explain to people the differences between them and sociopathy. I wanted to explain the origins and the theories. I interviewed a neuroscientist for the book, Dr. Douglas Fields, on Why We Snap. That's the name of his book. And he explained a lot about what happens to the human brain when somebody commits violence. And I am an Imago certified relationship therapist. And so what I really do is, and what I really am passionate about is helping people improve their relationship by looking at sort of the baggage they bring into relationships. And so I really wanted to look at what was going on with Chris and what he was projecting onto his wife, because, you know, I believe he was internally blaming her for all those problems. And I used my Imago theory and examined that too. And so I wanted to look at it from every single angle and show people that, you know, this is a complex thing. This isn't something that's just, hey, he's a psychopath and that's it. And that may be part of it, but there's so much more to it.
You said at the beginning, you talked about how there were no warning signs for Chris. And you also used the term perfect storm, and I had actually jotted that down in my notes. Was Shanann's personality and Chris's personality, did that create the perfect storm for no warning signs? Or had Shanann Bennett had a different personality, would those warning signs have manifested earlier?
I think that he had just constructed this identity, you know, which I talk about in the book, from a very young age as a child, you know, that he really prided himself on being this perfect person who everybody loved. And, you know, he prided himself on being easygoing and helpful. And I think that was in place long before he met Shanann. But that being said, he was always comfortable in the role of being the passive one. And so he was comfortable to let Shanann be the dominant one in the relationship. And he let her be that way, and I think she assumed that he was comfortable in that role, and I think that a lot of people saw them as this opposites attract. You know, this is a good match, but I think that inevitably Chris didn't like that, but he never vocalized that. You know, there was something in him that was resentful about that, and so I think that that came out, especially towards the end, because, you know, the last 5 or 6 weeks of his family's life, he was having an affair with a coworker. And so then I also get into what happens, you know, when you first meet someone and fall in love and what's going on with the brain. And so I think he was really comparing these two relationships and idealizing the affair and then devaluing what he had with his wife and, you know, unfairly projecting and blaming her for the problem.
I'm chatting with Lena Dirhali about her new book, My Daddy is a Hero, How Chris Watts Went from Family Man to Family Killer. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. You can get it on Amazon and other booksellers as well. Lena, the thing that also stood out to me is this crime wasn't typical in because people try to describe it as a family annihilation. Those usually end with the murder-suicide. You know, Chris would have been dead, too, had this been a true family annihilation. But when you look at this, did the motive itself, was that what differentiated this from a family annihilation case?
Yeah, you know, I think I had read up on the family annihilator stuff as well, and it seems like around 80% of these cases do end in suicide, and that the motives are often quite different. And, you know, the affair motive or the wanting to start a new life is definitely not in the top motives there. And that's where I think, you know, you're really looking at something that seems to be more in line with a psychopathic or narcissistic person. Or, you know, I'm not saying he's definitely those things, but there are those traits there, and that there was, you know, complete lack of empathy, entitlement, exploitation. Those are the three hallmarks of a narcissistic person or a psychopathic person, is that, you know, he really felt entitled to get this new life that he wanted, and he was willing to do anything, you know, to kill his own family to get what he wanted with complete lack of remorse, complete lack of empathy, complete lack of attachment to them. So I think that's what really kind of separates him from a classic family annihilator. I mean, he is a family annihilator because he annihilated them, but that wasn't really what I really was looking into when I wrote the book.
This is a cautionary tale because you explain a lot of things, how sometimes these traits can't manifest themselves. One of the things I noticed about Chris, though, was, and you pointed it out in the book, is that he showed kindness through his actions. And one of the examples was that Shanann was not a healthy person. I mean, she had medical problems, and Chris would sort her medications for her. And that stood out to me because I don't want people to take away that, oh my gosh, if you've got a guy showing you kindness, you're probably dealing with somebody that's going to go Chris Watts on you. So how do you differentiate these traits and to make sure that you aren't falsely reading somebody, I guess?
Yeah, I know that this is what's so hard about the case, is that Chris Watts was a consistent, helpful, nice guy for 8 years before he, you know, and it only took 5 or 6 weeks for him to meet someone else and decide to kill his family. So, I mean, again, that's what makes this story so unique, and why people, one of the reasons people are so fascinated with it, because it just doesn't make a lot of sense, and it's so hard to fathom. And you're right, you know, there are nice people who do those things. I think this stuff is hindsight is 20/20. There's something in my field that we call love bombing that is a sort of classic pattern of someone with narcissistic tendencies. And the love bombing is, and I've experienced it personally in a past relationship. So, you know, one of the things that you can use to differentiate it, or just to, I'd say just be suspicious of that, you know, keep your guard up a little, is if someone doesn't know you very well and they're just overly, you know, going over the top to win you over, and they don't know you well, they feel very certain that they want to be with you. You know, it takes a really long time to get to know someone for who they really are. And so, you know, oftentimes that's a projection. So either way, you know, whether it's, you know, most people aren't gonna murder you that love bomb you, you know, and so that's not the case at all. But you still want to think about taking things slow with somebody and being like, you know, hold up, how do you know you're so sure about me? It's been 2 weeks. You can't know that you're in love with me at that point, you know. So I think Chris was really, without knowing Shanann, I think he was captivated by her beauty. She was such a beautiful woman, and she was stunning, and she had this really, you know, bubbly personality that drew people to her, and I think he really liked that. And so, you know, he pursued her. She didn't want anything to do with him in the beginning. She pushed him away. She was in a dark place in her life. And with her, she was just diagnosed with her autoimmune diseases coming off a bad divorce. And Chris, like, he pulled out all the stops, you know. Within a few months, he was driving her to a colonoscopy and, you know, sorting her medications for her very, very early on. So he was really in hot pursuit of her. And I think, you know, looking back in hindsight, you know, it was a little bit over the top. And he didn't really know her that well. And he really was trying hard to win her over. And that can often be a sign of someone who is a little bit manipulative and has an agenda. But again, it's not always the case. There's nice people out there.
Well, and the other thing I noticed here is the in-laws didn't get along really with each other or with their, you know, their in-law son or son-in-law or daughter-in-law. How much did the conflict with the in-laws play into all this?
I think it was a factor in the perfect storm, but definitely not the main factor. But it was also what was kind of fueling Chris, I think, to blame Shanann because she didn't get along with his parents. And they had a blowout fight that summer when she was visiting them. And I think for him, he, in his mind, was thinking, you know, Shanann's keeping me from having a relationship with my family. And I think it fueled the resentment he had towards her. But I think, you know, that wasn't obviously the main factor, but it was definitely present and it was definitely a factor. And that's where I sort of use the imago relationship theory, because that's kind of a normal dynamic when we have couples in conflict, is they tend to sort of blame their partner for everything going wrong instead of also looking at themselves and looking at how they contribute to the dynamic.
You mentioned that Chris was having an affair with a coworker. Her name was Nikki. And in the book, she came off to me as a very sympathetic character because she's caught in the middle of this and not really, she wasn't part of it. Nonetheless, she's a factor in it. So as you look back at this, where does Nikki fit in as far as the emotional piece in this?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because people have really different reactions to Nikki, and she is very much hated in, you know, the community of people who follow the case, and there's people, you know, who think that she may have even had something to do with it. So it's really interesting to me that you found her to be sympathetic. And you know, in a way that means that I wrote it well because, you know, I had an attorney, I had an editor, and as we're writing it, you know, the whole time I wanted to be factual. I didn't want to give my opinions about Nikki. I wanted the reader to decide for themselves. So I just wanted to say it's interesting to hear that because, you know, that their people are going to have different reactions to her. I think she was it's not her fault that he killed them, but I think she was a driving factor. She was, you know, a major part of his motive. And, you know, I don't know if he would have killed his family if he hadn't met her. He may have eventually for someone else or something, but his draw to her, this intoxication that he had with her, this obsession, I think it really took hold of him. And I think one of the most interesting parts of the book is his Google searches. And if you recall, at one point in his affair with Nikki, he Googles, what does it feel like when someone says, I love you? And I thought, well, I mean, that was the real giveaway of who he was. You know, if you were to pick one thing in the book, because here he has this wife and these daughters, and he's constantly telling them he loves them and, you know, declaring how great they are. Yet as soon as he meets this mistress, he has to Google what it feels like when someone says, I love you. So he didn't really know, but obviously something in Nikki was stirring in him, which I think was lust and projection and idealizing her. But, it, you know, he was thinking in his head, well, maybe I'm in love for the first time.
The murders themselves, you describe them in the book as best as you can, because there was no trial, and I don't think we'll really ever get the full story out of Chris, but I think you can put it together. You warn the readers that you might want to skip it if you have a queasy stomach, but taking that back to the title of your book, My Daddy is a Hero, that came from a video that was made while the kids were in the car and one of the kids was singing to their dad. As you looked for titles for this book, how did you pull that particular moment to kind of put tie this all together?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the title was the hardest part of the book. I actually don't like the title, and I know that the title is a little bit controversial, and, you know, there's a lot of people that don't like the title, and I understand that, and I personally don't like the title either. And, you know, every single title I had, it was trying to capture the idea of, you know, John Glatt has a book coming out about this case in 2020, this month. Not this month, this year, at the end of July. And his is called The Perfect Father. And so I think, like, what he was doing is also trying to encapsulate what I was trying to, which is the idea that this man fooled everybody. And so, you know, I had these cliches in my mind, like, he's a wolf in sheep's clothing, you know, all of this type of stuff. But every title that we came up with that sort of, you know, showed this man who had fooled everybody, nobody liked those titles. And I had read, you know, someone had suggested the title, My Daddy is a Hero, and it was just the initial working title. We just held it in place because we couldn't find anything we liked better, and it just ended up staying, you know. And but I do think it's a really chilling look at how evil he really was and how he really fooled everybody, and, you know, the irony in that is, you know, it shows the magnitude of what he's done, that his daughter was singing that he was a hero, and then he killed her just weeks later. As I think that really sums up who he is.
The book is My Daddy is a Hero, How Chris Watts Went from Family Man to Family Killer by Lena Durhalli. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold. Go on Amazon or any place else you buy books and buy a copy of this. It was a very interesting read, and it's unlike any true crime book you'll read because it comes at it from a completely different angle, not a journalistic standpoint, but rather a therapeutic standpoint, and I learned a lot as a layperson. Lena Durhalli, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Brian. It was my pleasure.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Did you dream you'd be a hero someday? Who would grow up and change?